The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Pianist David Grylesummer has an eclectic repertoire and often pairs unusual musicians on his recordings, such as his recording of sonatas by Baroque musician Domenico Scarlatti and avant-garde American composer John Cage. Since 2013, he's also been music and artistic director of the Geneva Camerata, which performs music of all periods and styles, from Baroque to contemporary, electronic, jazz, rock, and world music, and which brings together music, dance, theater, and visual arts. David Grylesummer joins me by telephone to talk about his international career as a musician. Welcome.
Hi.
So first things first, how are you doing in these very strange times we're living in?
Indeed, these are very, very, very strange times and quite challenging and difficult for our cultural and musical world, I have to say. I am currently in Europe, in the city of Geneva, where I'm directing the Geneva Camerata, as you mentioned, and as you know, Europe was hit by a very ferocious second wave. So we were lucky to start our season in September and October, but sadly, it was all cut off, and we had to stop because of this new wave. So things are difficult, we are looking at obviously at the future. We're trying to stay very optimistic, and we are rather confident that in the next few months things will start getting back to normal. And the orchestra is really, really looking forward to performing again. Obviously, you know, there have been a lot of videos going on in the world, but we feel that, and I feel very strongly that the live audience will never be replaced. It's really not the same. Mm-hmm. So we're patiently waiting for the moment that we can perform again, and we're preparing the future. It's a good time to prepare new challenging and beautiful projects, I'm really looking forward to starting fresh and new very soon.
Mm. Well, hear, hear. I hope that's true.
Yeah.
I'd like to dial it back and talk to you about your introduction to music as a child. I'm curious to know when you started playing and when and how you got serious about your music.
So I was lucky to be born into a very musical family. My parents were not professional musicians. They're actually both professors at the university, so they're not musicians, but they're both tremendous music lovers and actually art lovers. So, when I was a kid, I'm the eldest of five brothers.
Yeah.
When we were kids growing up, our parents would take us to concerts and museums and to theater shows, etc. So we were really lucky to grow up in a place where arts were considered to be absolutely essential. And I'm very grateful to my family for that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the oldest, so when I came to the world, my mom had already decided that she really wanted her first child to play the piano. That was really a big thing for her. I think she always loved the piano, and so, you know, she bought a little upright Yamaha piano, and that's how it all started.
Yeah.
And I started at the age of six in Israel, where I was born and raised. And this is little by little how things, started, and how this journey was initiated. And all my brothers are either professional musicians or they were performing music and now are doing it for, you know, for their pleasure. And but it's still a very, very musical, artistic family. So these are the very beginnings of the journey.
Wow. Are all of you pianists or do your brothers play other instruments?
No. So I play the piano and I conduct. And then I have one brother right after me who's actually a violinist originally and has become over the years a pop rock violinist. And a singer. He's quite a star in Israel, and she's you know, performing with his band, pop rock, world music, reggae music. Sometimes we even perform together. It's quite nice. And then I have a brother who's a cellist, a brother who's playing piano, guitar, and violin. And then I have another pianist who's a baroque musician, actually, and he's a baroque. He plays harpsichord and conducts baroque ensembles here in Europe. So it's quite a wild, diverse family in terms of music and arts.
Wow, that's amazing. You said your parents are university professors. What are their fields?
Yeah. So my mother is a historian of medieval times, Middle Ages, and she's actually a world-renowned specialist in the study of witches in the Middle Ages.
Wow!
So that's really her thing, witches. And my father is a political science professor and kind of modern history professor.
Wow. Wow. What an accomplished family you have. That's marvelous. It's marvelous.
Quite a diverse, intense, you know, very intense and busy family.
Yeah. It explains a little bit, I think, maybe about some of your broad interests as well. And that gets really to my next question. You know, I think people often segment musical eras, musical genres into these little sort of restrictive and self-contained boxes. You know, it's Baroque
Absolutely.
Or it's not. It's Mozart or it's not. It's contemporary
Exactly.
or it's not.
Exactly.
And, you know, I'm a musician myself, and I experience music as way more interrelated, not these disconnected little islands.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate that you refuse to be contained by those arbitrary boundaries. I really think if someone enjoys music by Jean-Baptiste Lully, played beautifully, why wouldn't they also possibly enjoy Scriabin or Cage or Crumb? And it almost seems like musicians
Absolutely.
Are the most adamant about preserving those arbitrary divisions. So I'm curious to know if you have any theory about where that comes from, what that's about, and, you know, why you...
Well, you know, yeah, you know, you're... You are now kind of putting the finger on one of the most one of the issues that are most important to me and that have driven me to do what I do today. Because as you said so precisely and very very rightly so, the problem that we've been having in the classical music industry is that for some reason, for many, many years, people in this music world have wanted to put us, and I say us, I mean musicians, composers, you know, theaters, all the people in the musical world, we have been put into those little boxes. And as you said, for some reason, you know, if you're a Baroque musician, that probably means you can only do that. Mm-hmm. And if you're a romantic, I don't know, specialist of Rachmaninoff, then you can only do that. Mm-hmm. And if you are like a contemporary music specialist, then probably you only do these very, very modern composers, and you do mm-hmm. John Cage and Boulez and all these guys, and mm-hmm. for sure you cannot do all these things. And I've been fighting this conception for many, many years, and I'm so happy that you bring that up, because that is, to me, the heart of what we should be aiming at. And this is also, in my personal opinion, one of the answers to how we can expand our public in the classical music world, how we can hopefully bring in more auditors from the young generation. How can we bring more students to the concert halls, et cetera, and I feel very strongly about that issue. And I see the answer is truly bringing together all these different styles and creating a dialogue. It's not about just mixing things just for the sake of mixing them. It's truly this idea that different kinds of music and different forms of art can have a beautiful dialogue. They can meet each other, even if it wasn't supposed to be that way. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. They can meet, they can converse, they can create a beautiful conversation. And this is how we can, in my opinion, bring classical music to the next level, to a place where there is a dialogue and that we can all enjoy it in a much more liberated way. And all the projects that I've been working on in the last few years have been going in that direction for that very specific reason, and because mm-hmm. of that issue that you mentioned in mm-hmm. your question.
Yeah. And you sort of have this reputation, and they use these words, you know, you're a risk taker as a performer. And I'm curious to know what that means to you as a musician. It's almost like it's a compliment, but it almost could be considered sort of a left-handed compliment in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really the heart of the problem, is that, you know, when you are curious, when you are a curious person, and I believe this is such an important thing, to be curious, by the way, not just about music. It's important to be curious about everything and to take part in a bigger conversation, to be interested in and curious about, you know, other kinds of music, to be interested in other kinds of arts, but also to be interested in environment, to be interested in social issues. These are very, very important. I don't think you can be a musician if you're just interested in your own little world and you don't care or want to understand what's going on around you. And so I mentioned this because even when I perform the music of the past, and I have the greatest, you know, admiration for the great composers like Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Schumann, and all of these incredible creators and artists. But every time I perform these composers, I try to remember in which world I live in. And I try to remember that all these composers from the past still need to be connected to the world that I am living in today. Mm. And that, to me, is extremely meaningful, to try and find a way to bring all these ideas from the past and to make them live today in our present times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a perfect segue to my next question. And I have my own opinions about this, which are irrelevant right now because I want to hear your opinion. But Baroque music played on the piano is still, even in the year 2020, almost 2021, a controversial thing for some people. And, you know, yeah. Here we are. And I would like to know your take on that as someone who is a pianist, as someone who presents such compelling and interesting and beautiful performances of Baroque music on the piano. I want to hear your take on that.
Well, you're opening up, you know, this subject, this issue, which to me is one of the most fascinating and important issues, you know, in classical music today. And as you can imagine, this question is is really, really present every day, in everything that I do. This question of what is the role of the modern piano in, you know, Baroque music, but even in a broader sense, in ancient old music. What do we do with that? And you know, there's no need, I think, to get into this huge controversy of can pianists nowadays play Baroque, or should it be only on harpsichord and organ, etc. I don't think that these are the right questions. I think that if we want to understand and truly find the answers to this debate, I think we need to ask the right questions, and the right questions are in a much different place. And to me, it's much more related to a question of creativity, to a question of imagination, to a question of understanding of what we are trying to do. Because playing Johann Sebastian Bach on piano can sound incredible and very innovative and eclectic and beautiful and unique, and it can also sound absolutely terrible. And so can we play Bach on modern piano is not the right question. The question is, as interpreters, what do we do with it? And again, I go back to the issue that we were discussing before. If I, as a pianist, decide to play Bach on a modern piano, I need to ask myself, why do I do that? And why do I do that today? How do I relate that music from the past, from the very old past, how do I relate it to our world today? If I can bring an answer to that, if I can bring something new, if I can make this music live in my time, then for sure, it doesn't matter what style I choose, then it will be interesting. It will be unique. If I just play Bach because I feel, you know, I should play Bach on the piano and I don't know why I am doing it, then I don't think it's gonna work. And, you know, if you take the greatest pianists who have played Baroque music on piano, for instance, you know, Glenn Gould, obviously, is a good example. Some people love it, some people hate it, but everybody can agree that he played Bach on a piano in a very unique way, in a very unusual way. And I think it's because he knew what he wanted to create. He heard sounds in his mind, and he was trying to express them. And so, you know, I think, but it's the same for harpsichord. If you play harpsichord, a Baroque piece on the harpsichord, that doesn't mean that it's going to sound beautiful. It's not because you play it on the harpsichord that automatically it's going to be perfect just because it's supposed to be the right instrument. I think it's all about understanding why we do certain things that we do. And I think even for, you know, my favorite harpsichord and Baroque players, you know, have been the ones that, even though they were playing instruments from the past, they were still extremely, extremely innovative and brought something completely new to the conversation and made me hear the harpsichord in a completely different way, in a modern way, in a visionary way. So, again, I think that the real debate is not if it's good or bad to play Baroque music on piano. It's what can we do to make it alive today? And if we have an answer to that, then everything works out absolutely perfectly.
Yeah, sometimes I hear from a listener who feels that Baroque music should only be played on historical instruments, and they'll often say, you know, it's not the same. You know, it's not the same if you play it on piano versus harpsichord. And my response to that is, yes, that's exactly the point.
Of course.
If it were the same, there would be no reason. So,
yeah, I mean, of course, it's not the same. And I think that this conversation is a bit problematic also because, you know, you can go much further. You know, the piano that we're playing on Mozart is not the right piano.
Right.
And you know, if you look at later on Schumann and Chopin and, you know, even in the 19th century, you know, truth is when you play a beautiful Chopin piece, it's not on the right piano, so to speak, you know.
Right. So, Right.
You know, if we want to change everything, then we have to, you know, it goes all the way throughout music history.
Right.
But it's, that's not the right debate. As you mentioned, what's interesting is to create something different. Of course, Mozart on a modern piano is going to sound different than Mozart on the piano that he had back in the 18th century or playing Bach on the organ that he was playing on. Of course, it's going to sound different, but again, if I can produce something unique with it, and if I can produce a sound that belongs to our modern times, and it's different, then again, this means that I can create something new and innovative, and I think that's what makes living today and creating today and thinking today something that's really worth fighting for, instead of just looking at the past all the time and saying, oh, I wish I sounded like this. And I just to be clear, I adore great performers who play on Baroque instruments, and I adore the great period instruments ensemble and Baroque, the great Baroque masters. I absolutely adore them, and I've been tremendously influenced by, you know, great Baroque orchestras and by great Baroque harpsichord players, etc. It's incredible when it's well played. However, as a pianist, I try to make the sound of the past relate to my life today.
Yeah, I mean, art is not stagnant. It doesn't live in that vacuum. Again, it gets back to those little boxes, those little self-contained things. It's alive, and that this is I believe this is how it stays relevant. Is that new musicians look at it and they play it on different instruments and they explore it in different artistic ways, and it's in the interpretation, not in the instrument. It's in the player.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're also a conductor, and you have led some really terrific orchestras all over the world, and you also often conduct an orchestra from the piano as you play a solo with the group.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the one hand, that's, you know, a really great feeling of leadership, but I would imagine it's also maybe a little bit nerve-wracking. Would you talk a little bit about what that is like? You know, that you know, you're sort of multitasking when you're doing that.
Yeah, you know, I always say that when you do that, when you play and conduct at the same time, you have to be a little bit schizophrenic in the sense that you kind of have to divide your brain and your whole body into two equal parts. One has to be extremely concentrated, focused on the piano playing, and the other one has to be focused on not just the conducting part, but really bringing the best out of the orchestra at the same time that you're playing the piano and inspiring the orchestra at the same time, and giving the orchestra the wings that it needs to really have an amazing performance. And so there is a little bit that effect of dividing yourself into two completely different entities. But I absolutely love doing that. I love conducting from my instrument, conducting from the piano. I've done this many, many, many times now in the past few years with different orchestras around the world. And I love it because it gives me the possibility as a performer to really be inside of the sound of the orchestra. For many years, I used to be a little bit frustrated, even performing, you know, as a pianist under great conductors, I would always be a little bit frustrated because I would feel that, in a way, there's a bit too many different vibes and different things going on stage, and I really wanted to have this direction, this direct connection with the orchestra and with mm-hmm. the players themselves. And so, you know, when you are actually both the pianist and the conductor, you are so close to the musicians. You're really among the musicians. You're one of them. And I absolutely love this feeling of being among the musicians. You really feel their breath. You feel their heart beating. You mm-hmm. feel, you know, you're there with them. And it's very different than, you know, just being the soloist or just being the conductor, because you're much, you know, even physically, you're far away. Mm-hmm. You're not, you know, you're not truly feeling this immense energy that you mm-hmm. feel when you are part of the orchestra. And so I've learned to absolutely cherish and enjoy these moments of playing and conducting. And nowadays, I have to say, when I, especially for Mozart, Beethoven, you know, for this 18th century repertoire, mm-hmm. I do it almost always now. And I that's the way I enjoy doing it the most. But I have to say, I've done it now with many other repertoires. I've even recorded, you know, the Ravel piano concerto from the keyboard, playing and conducting. I've done Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue from the keyboard, and many, many other romantic and even 20th century pieces. It's just fun. It's just a fun way to make music, and I love doing it.
I would love for you to talk a little bit about your work with Geneva Camerata, because I think it is, you know, the repertory and the approach is really innovative and really distinct. And I'd really like for you to talk more about, you know, what your mission is and what some of your, maybe your favorite projects are with the group.
Yeah. So Geneva Camerata was really created, started about 8 years ago in Geneva, Switzerland. And when it started, the idea, you know, Geneva is a very central city in Europe. It's right in the middle of Europe, actually. And so one of the great things about it is that it's the access to the city is very, very easy. You know, you're just 3 hours away from Paris. You're just, you know, 1 hour by plane from Berlin or from London. You're just 3 hours from Milan in Italy. And so it's very central, very easy to get. And the idea, I mentioned this because in the orchestra, from the very beginning, we had musicians coming pretty much from, not just from all European cities, but from many, many international different places around the world. And the idea when it was created was to not just create another orchestra just for the sake of having another orchestra. We all know that there's so many symphony orchestras in the world, chamber orchestras, many, many. And you know, there's no need to have another orchestra. So the idea was to create a completely different orchestra, a completely different way of making music. And this is how the whole process started, of first of all, choosing and, you know, selecting one by one musicians, not by audition, by the way, but really by knowing musicians around the world who have this very unique profile to them. And when I say profile, I mean musicians who are obviously extraordinary virtuosos. But beyond that, musicians, we were looking for musicians who had the capability of offering things that many times we don't see in the classical world. So, for instance, our musicians have the capacity to perform jazz with amazing jazz musicians and even improvise with them. We have musicians who have not only performed classical music, but who have been part of rock bands in their life. We have musicians who play in avant-garde and contemporary music ensembles. We have also musicians who play baroque on period instruments in some of the finest Baroque ensembles in Europe, et cetera, et cetera. So we really have a spectrum of artists in the orchestra who come from all sorts of genres, styles, and who have the ability to offer something that is, that goes way, way beyond just performing a traditional classical concert. And the idea behind it at the very beginning was, first of all, to think about how we can open classical music to new audiences, because we all know it, and I think we can admit it, is that, you know, for a very long time, classical music has been viewed by many, many people, and still today, as kind of an elitist art, and it's been viewed as something that not everybody can access, not everybody can, you know, understand. And I've been, you know, this has been very, very important to me, to try and find new ways, original, new kind of ways of bringing classical music to more audiences, younger audiences. My conclusion was that we need to have musicians that are audacious, musicians who are willing to take risks on stage. Mm-hmm. And so this is how it all started, really wanting to create projects that are completely different and that bring together different kinds of music, but also that bring to projects that bring together different forms of art. And this is how very early on, and when the orchestra was created, we started bringing dance into our projects. We started bringing theater into our projects. We started bringing visual arts into our project. I'll just give you an example of one of our most successful projects, which we've performed all over the world, including last season in New York. This was the orchestra's debut in the U.S., and this project is called Dance of the Sun, and it's a project in which the entire orchestra, so about 35 musicians, play by memory great masterpieces by Mozart and by Lully, and at the same time, while they play by memory, they also dance. So you have an entire orchestra that is dancing on a contemporary choreography, and also play. They all play by memory these great masterpieces from the past. And so this is just an example of the kind of projects that we've been creating. But we've been doing things like that with, you know, music and even circus arts, working with, you know, acrobats, acrobatics, and working also with painters and with poets and with comedians, obviously, and et cetera, et cetera. So we try to bring music to as many people as we can by inviting other kinds of arts, other kinds of music into our world, and offering our world to other kinds of arts. And this really has been our biggest mission, I would say, in the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Boy, dancing as you play from memory, that sort of gets into that schizophrenic multitasking thing you talked about, of playing the piano as you lead the orchestra. Or maybe even more so. Your recordings are very much like what you described as well with the Geneva Camerata. You have combined, like, for example, with the 2020 Labyrinth recording, you've combined music by Baroque composers like Bach and Lully and Marais and Rebel, but you've also paired it with Janáček and Ligeti and George Crumb and Satie and Granados, and even the living musician Ofer Peltz. Could you talk a little bit about the creative impetus behind that particular program, that recording?
Absolutely. You know, I know I've been intensely working on, as we discussed earlier in this conversation, I've been working on trying to find new ways to have a broader and wider conversation about music, and that means how we can create interesting dialogues between, you know, I'm always fascinated by one thing, and it is how what happens when two different worlds or two different planets that were never supposed to meet or to collide. What happens at that precise moment when these two worlds meet? What happens? And this question, this precise question, has been really, it's been part of me for a very, very long time. And all the projects that I've been involved in now in the last few years have been asking this question: what happens when different worlds collide? And I'm just fascinated by that question. And this new recording, Labyrinth, explores that very question. And to me, it goes much further than any other recording that I've done, not just because I feel it's in a way more radical and more adventurous, but because it has such a personal story behind it, such an intimate story, which I tell a little bit in the program notes inside of the booklet of the album. And this is that when I was a teenager, I had this recurring dream that would come back and haunt me. And it came back for years and years and years, almost night after night. And in this dream, I was kind of trapped in this huge labyrinth. And I didn't know what to do. And it was a very, very, very intense dream. You know, I was running in this labyrinth, trying to find new doors to open. And then, you know, it's not the right door. So going back and running and running and running, and at some point falling and then getting up again and then running again and trying to find another way out. And this dream, it wasn't a nightmare. It wasn't a bad dream. It was just so intense, so mysterious, so weird. And I kept on asking myself all these years, why does it come back? Why does it come back? And, you know, obviously time went by and I didn't really do anything with it until the day that I finally realized that many of the questions that I've been asking myself all these years and creating all these different projects with music and trying to combine between past and present, trying to create these dialogues, maybe it's related to that dream. Maybe it's time for me to do something with it in a much more precise and advanced way. And this is how, about 5 years ago, I woke up one day and I just said to myself, you know, this is the time. I have to bring back this dream and express it in music. And this is how the process started of trying to find the pieces or the sounds or the fragments that seem to be in that dream. And I knew that by doing that, I would take a very radical path, in the sense that it would necessarily mean for sure that all these different styles would have to meet and really collide, not just two composers, but many different composers. And so this is how the process of creating this Labyrinth album started. And I decided also to present it and to express it in a way that to me resembled very much how you would write a novel with different chapters. And I basically laid it out in seven different chapters in this album. And each chapter has three pieces and the composer comes back and it has a very, very specific order, very structured order. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping that by creating this album, I would better understand what happened to me in that dream, why I would be so lost in that labyrinth. And through these sounds, through the creation of this album, I was able little by little to find some of the answers that I've been looking for for so many years.
Does that mean then that some of these pieces, or maybe all of these pieces, are ones that you have found elusive in that way and intense in that way? You know, sort of confronting confronting that challenge that you did in the dream, but confronting it with this music, or those particular pieces, ones that you found particularly personally challenging in some way?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say, you know, when any of us wakes up in the morning after a very, very intense dream, you know, sometimes what happens is that there's like a fragment of something that happened to us, and then there's another fragment that has nothing to do with it. And then sometimes, you know, in a dream, we meet somebody that we haven't seen actually for like 15 years. And, you know, that's the amazing thing about dreams, is that they can look like they make absolutely no sense. But then when we dive into them, we sometimes realize how meaningful these encounters are. And in a way, that gave me the platform, the possibility to create this almost this clash, I would say, between these different styles. And it enabled me to bring together composers that normally would have absolutely nothing to do with each other. You know, for instance, you mentioned George Crumb, who's one of my favorite composers, and to me, like, really an American icon. And you know, one would think that the music of George Crumb has absolutely nothing to do with Beethoven and no connection. But for some reason, when I related that to my dream and to this anxiety that I was feeling running in this maze, it made so much sense that this piece by George Crumb would be encircled by two short pieces by Beethoven. And so this, just as an example, is how the album was created. I took two very radical pieces by Beethoven, the Bagatelles from the end of his life, which I had never performed before, and it was really the first time that I was learning these pieces. I've been wanting to do it for a long time, but I was missing something, and suddenly I realized this extraordinary piece by Crumb, The Magic Circle of Infinity. It's you know, on the paper it shouldn't be related, but actually it works so perfectly with these two pieces by Beethoven. Same thing in another part of the album with Bach and Ligeti, or with you have this later on with this piece by you have Rebel and Scriabin at the very, very end of the album, etc., etc. So in a way, opening all these doors in my dream, this maze, helps me understand that I can be much more radical. I can go even further and run even a wider distance if I want, and open doors that maybe before that would not open. And that's what I say. This the fact that this project came from such an intimate personal place, the fact that it all happened this way, enabled me as a musician to find new creative solutions to many of the problems and many of the questions that I was, you know, really asking myself for so many years.
So given this kind of creative percolating that goes on in your head, and given the fact that you mentioned earlier in our conversation that you've been using this time of isolation to, you know, generate new ideas and focus on new things, what's next? What are you working on now, or at least percolating in your mind?
So, you know, with the Geneva Camerata, for instance, we're not performing these days because of the pandemic, but we're preparing some very, very challenging and beautiful projects that go just along the lines of what we were discussing. So I'll just, as a little example, next May, and I'm really crossing fingers that by next May, things should somewhat be back to normal. We have this huge project in which the entire orchestra, we're going to be, I think, almost 45 or 50 people performing Dvorak's New World Symphony by memory, and dancing on a completely new choreography that's created these days by one of the Paris Opera stars, who's also a fantastic choreographer. And she is creating this completely new choreography on Dvorak's New World Symphony. And the whole orchestra is going to learn it, learn the music by heart, but also learn the choreography by heart. And I think it's going to be a very powerful project. And you know, on the piano side of things, you know, I was supposed to have this very substantial international tour with the Labyrinth, because at the end of the day, as much as I enjoy recording, I love even more performing live in front of a real audience. And I was supposed to have this very big international tour. Obviously, now it's been postponed. I was supposed to come to the U.S., by the way, this coming February for the premiere of this Labyrinth. And so I'm hoping that all this Labyrinth tour is going to happen very soon, despite everything. And I would also say that I'm already preparing some now that Labyrinth has been, you know, out into this world, I'm working on some new and even crazier and more radical projects, which I'll probably reveal sometime very soon.
Okay, it's very intriguing. Well, I have been speaking with David Grilesheimer, pianist, conductor, and innovative musician. Thank you very, very much for chatting with me.
Thank you. Thank you.